Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Today, we start a mini-series on the maritime history of Sweden. This forms part of a programme begun last year to create a strong international foundation to the podcast. We've produced numerous episodes on maritime China, maritime Africa, maritime Australia, and as a man of proud Welsh heritage, we started it all off with a series on the maritime history of Wales. So do go back and get listening to all of those. But for now, it's maritime Sweden. I was lucky enough to spend a little time in Sweden recently, meeting a number of their fantastic maritime historians and archaeologists. And today I can introduce you to one of them, Fred Hocker, who has the enviable job of being Director of Research at the Vasa Museum. Fred has spoken with us before about the Vasa, that great 17th century warship that was sunk on its maiden voyage, so be sure to listen to that. But today, Fred is introducing our mini-series on maritime Sweden by talking more broadly about Sweden's fascinating naval history from about 1500 on to the present day, and he explains how Sweden's modern defence thinking has been shaped by the previous 500 years. As always, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Here is the fascinating and formidably factual Fred. Fred, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Oh, pleasure to talk to you again, Sam.
So, this is a large subject we're going to be tackling today. Where's a sensible place to start it?
Gosh, because we're talking about the 400 years before Sweden joined NATO, basically,
yes.
and how naval history has contributed to current Swedish defense thinking.
Exactly. That's it. In a nutshell.
Yeah.
How about the 16th century? Is it worth going back before that, or is the 16th century sensible?
Well, we could go all the way back. I mean, last year we celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Swedish Navy, which we reckon from when the first modern king of Sweden, Gustav Eriksson, Gustav I, hired and purchased ships from Lübeck to provide a navy for his revolt against the king of Denmark, Christian II. Sweden had been part of a three-way joint monarchy since the 14th century, called the Kalmar Union, under the Danish royal house. And Gustav Eriksson was a noble who, together with a bunch of like-minded nobles, decided they disliked what they considered the tyrannical rule of the Danish king and wanted to be independent again. And so they fought a revolt for a year and a half or so and managed to essentially defeat Christian's forces. And part of what he needed for that was a navy. And he understood that because Sweden had so much coastline and all of its commercial and political contacts were on the other side of the Baltic Sea, that a navy was essential to establishing the state. And so he purchased and hired a number of ships for that first campaign for the revolt. And then realized that a navy was going to be a central feature of Swedish foreign policy. And so after he was crowned king, Sweden became independent again, that he established the navy on a more or less permanent footing. It tended to wax and wane with the political problems of the time until the 17th century, when his grandson, 100 years later, Gustav Adolf, decided that Sweden needed a permanent navy of purpose-built warships, both in peacetime and in wartime. There would be essentially a fixed establishment that could be used as a tool for international relations. And so technically we could say the Navy is 500 years old, but in the Navy, the way we think of a Navy today is a permanent institution of purpose-built combat and warships is really a 400-year-old phenomenon.
Okay. And did they establish dockyards around that period? Is that at the same time we can see it really having roots?
Yeah, they did. Gustav Eriksson, Gustav Vasa, we sometimes call him, Gustav I, established a central maintenance and supply facility in Stockholm, the Stockholm Navy Yard, Skeppsgården it was called. It was on an island called Skeppsholmen, Ship Island, which is not the current island of that name. It's now the part of town called Blasieholmen. And he established that as kind of a maintenance and supply facility, but not for the construction of new ships. His government and for 100 years afterwards decided that it would be more cost effective rather than building all your ships in a central facility. It'd be more cost effective to build the ships where the trees were. Because that you could then take advantage of all the local peasant labor for harvesting the trees, getting them to the shipyard. And so you'd set up a shipyard where there was appropriate timber, build one or two ships until you had exhausted that local supply. And then the next time you needed to build ships, you'd set up a yard somewhere else. And the Navy did that for almost 100 years until about 1618, when Gustav Adolf had the idea that he needed to renew the Navy and he needed to have a very steady program of shipbuilding. And he didn't have enough trained shipwrights to distribute them all over the countryside that way. So he consolidated new construction into basically one yard or two yards. So the Stockholm Yard became the main center for the construction of new ships as well as maintenance and supply.
Did you guys have all of the timber you needed, or did you need to import a lot of it? Because when you build a ship, you need all sorts of different types of wood. And you have one, I'm thinking you have plentiful sources of lovely straight pines for planks and stuff like that and masts.
But, right.
What about the oak and things like that for the hull?
Right. Well, and actually timber supply is a tricky question for shipbuilding. People often talk about how, England was denuded of timber by the shipbuilding industry, which is not really true. It's mostly the metals industry, because it doesn't matter what kind of tree you burn, it still burns to smelt metal. But for shipbuilding, you need very, very specific kinds of trees. You need long, straight trees for things like keels and deck beams and planks, but you also need broad, curving trees to make all the curved timbers in the ship, like frames, the stem, timbers like that. And oak is the ideal shipbuilding timber. It's very durable. It's very widely distributed. It's readily available. And it's an unusual sort of tree in that it grows both in dense stands of long straight trees or as solitary trees out in fields with big spreading curved branches. And the basic species of oak that people use in Northern Europe, there are two species, Quercus robur, Quercus petraea, that are really hard to tell apart. And, they're very similar. But they're available just about everywhere. And even in Sweden, oak grows up until about, an hour's drive north of Stockholm. So Sweden had substantial oak reserves. And then by the 18th century, those were starting to run out. The really good timber, because you can't just clear cut a forest and use it. You have to send shipwrights into the forest and they're picking one tree out of 100. That's a good tree to make a keel out of. That tree is a good timber for the stem, that sort of thing. So the Navy Yard had gangs of carpenters going around the countryside looking for trees. And the king had a right to every oak tree in the country. He also had estates of his own that he could supply timber from. And the Crown did that for a long time, up into until the 1620s. But they also had, Swedes will tell you that the king owned every oak tree in the country. That's not true. The king had a right to use them, that if a king needed an oak tree on your property, you couldn't refuse to sell it to him, because it was a strategic resource. But what's interesting is that although Sweden was very rich in those kinds of natural resources, had a very small population. And once the military machine really got going in the 17th century, the people who you would be counting on to be woodcutters and dragging timber from the forests down to the water to be loaded on boats, a lot of those people have been conscripted into the army and they're not there anymore. So this very thinly distributed population makes it very expensive to extract the resources out of the Swedish landscape. And the big emphasis was on the metals industry, on copper and iron. So that took up a lot of the available labor. By the 1620s, when the crown started using private contractors to build ships, they found it was actually cost-effective rather than sourcing all the timber in Sweden. They were buying somewhere between a third and a half of their timber abroad. Even though there was perfectly good timber in Sweden, it was more cost-effective to get it out of areas that had a better developed forest industry. So they would send gangs around Sweden to find the curved timbers that had to match the pattern, the shape of the ship. But we can see from the purchase receipts in the 1620s, for example, that once they went to the private contracting, they were also sending purchasing agents to Poland and to Amsterdam, the big timber markets, to buy rough sawn planks and then shipping those back to Sweden. And that, and even though the freight cost for timber was something like 80% of its wholesale cost at the market, that was still more cost effective than trying to collect the necessary peasant labor you needed to extract trees out of the forest within Sweden.
Yeah. What about canvas and iron, other things you need for shipbuilding?
Well, Sweden was self-sufficient in metals. And in fact, Swedish iron was of the highest possible quality. The ore that we have in Sweden is very low in impurities. And so it makes very good wrought iron and also is a good basis for making steel. Royal Navy in England, for all of the 17th century and most of the way through the 18th century, specified Swedish iron for all of its hardware, because it was of higher quality than could be produced in England until the English Industrial Revolution developed more effective iron refining methods. And so Sweden had no trouble sourcing metals, copper for guns, iron for nails and bolts. All of that was sourced within Sweden. And the crown had very good access to that material. Even if it was controlled, it might be controlled by private entrepreneurs. The crown had a beneficial relationship. Canvas was an entirely different matter. The best quality canvas for ship sails in these days was made out of hemp. By the 18th century, you know, we're used to thinking of flax as the main material, and then later cotton. But the most desirable material in the 17th century, 16th and 17th centuries, is hemp. And hemp is actually a little tricky to grow. It's not like linen, flax, which you can grow almost anywhere. And even though hemp is a weed that can grow a lot of places, the right quality to make sailcloth out of has to be cultivated very carefully, has to be processed very carefully. And there really wasn't a very good hemp industry within Sweden. And so Sweden imported all of its naval hemp for rope and canvas well into the 17th century. And even after they had an industry that made sailcloth within Sweden, they were often making it out of imported fiber. And the best quality hemp, if you bought the raw fiber, came out of the Eastern Baltic, out of ports like Riga and Tallinn in what's now Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. And those same sources that a lot of Western places were using. But the Swedish Navy, before the 1660s-ish, really depended on buying cloth rather than buying fiber and weaving it. So they had merchants who were buying cloth. And the best quality sailcloth was made in France, in northern France, at places like Vitry and Noyal. And in fact, the Tudor English Navy had depended very heavily on French-made sailcloth from places like Poldovi. And by the 17th century, the Royal Navy was increasingly taking advantage of cloth made in Ipswich and other places in Suffolk to provide its needs, but was still buying sailcloth in France when they weren't at war with France. If you couldn't get French sailcloth, the next best quality was Dutch cloth, Hollandsdoek, as it was called. And that was made in a town called Comenia, which is in the big shipbuilding centers in North Holland. But if you were buying that sort of stuff, you could buy both French cloth and Dutch cloth in the market in Amsterdam.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And we know, for example, for Vasa, the Swedish Navy in its supply contracts for most of the 17th century specified French cloth if it was available for their sales, and had merchants dealing with factors who could source French cloth, but buying it in Amsterdam.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. So it starts off with the Danes being the problem. And when did it change to the Russians being the problem?
For the first 200 years or so, a little bit less of modern Swedish history, from the 1520s into the, the 1670s, Sweden's traditional mortal enemy was Denmark. They were the two great kingdoms fighting for dominance in the Baltic. And for a lot of that period, there was always a third player, which was the Dutch, because the Dutch controlled the Baltic trade, the richest trade in the world in the Swedish and the Dutch golden age of the 17th century is not the silks and spices of the Far East. It's the really boring bulk commodities like timber, grain, and dried fish coming out of the Baltic to feed and house and fuel the growing cities of Western Europe. And the Dutch controlled that trade, which they reckoned to be worth twice as much as the silks and spices of the Far East. So the Dutch Golden Age is really heavily based on that. And so if there was ever a war between Sweden and Denmark, which there was maybe every 15 to 20 years, the Dutch would jump in on the weaker side so that no side could actually achieve dominance or hegemony in the Baltic. Because if they did, then they might want to shut the Dutch out and take over the trade themselves. So they were intent on maintaining a balance between Sweden and Denmark, which they did quite successfully all through the 16th and into the 17th centuries. Until in the last major war, naval war that the Dutch and the Swedes and the Danes fought in the 1670s, called the Scanian War, or the Skåne War, where Denmark was trying to regain control of what's now Western Sweden, which had formerly been Denmark. And as was typical in the wars between Sweden and Denmark, the Danes won all the battles and then lost the peace negotiations. They always chose the wrong moment to start negotiating, rather than when they were at the point of their greatest strength, they started negotiating. They got greedy, would go too far, and the Swedes would start to recover. And so they rarely achieved their goals. So the war that in which the Scanian War, which was about recovering Scania ended up resulting in the permanent loss of Scania. And that was pretty much the end of Denmark as a major naval contender in the Baltic with Sweden. By the end of the 17th century, Russia had emerged from the time of troubles, as they call it there, of internal strife and dynastic bickering and civil war to try to figure out who was going to be the Tsar. And when Peter the Great came to the throne, he really said it created the modern Russian state, a unified state ruling over a very large territory. And he modernized that state from its medieval organization. And one of the things he was intent on was naval power. He famously studied shipbuilding himself, masquerading as a shipwright in Dutch shipyards, supposedly. He traveled widely to try to learn all the things he needed to know to make Russia into a modern empire. And so Russia, which had been shut out of the Baltic from 1617, the Peace of Stolbova, had reemerged into the Baltic under Peter the Great and started building up a substantial fleet. And then in what in Sweden is called, and also elsewhere, the Great Northern War of the early 18th century, had land and naval components. And that's where Russia really emerged as Sweden's primary opponent, as it is today. And so for the last 300 years and a little bit more, Swedish defense policy has leaned east. It's always been assumed that the primary enemy will be Russia. Russia may be able to attract some allies, but Swedish defense has, for more than 300 years, assumed that the enemy will be Russia. And in most of the wars fought in the 18th century until the last major land campaign that Sweden was engaged in the Napoleonic period, Russia was the enemy.
And how is the sort of the shape of that relationship changing in the modern world today?
Well, Sweden, after it lost Finland to Russia in its last major war in the Napoleonic period, embarked on a policy of armed neutrality, of non-alliance in various ways, and concentrated on building up an internal defense. There was a big period in the 19th century of building all of these huge inland fortifications as a kind of citadel of retreat should Sweden be invaded by the Russians. And they couldn't be stopped at the coast, and these central fortresses would be the area from which Sweden would counterattack. And then in the 20th century, Sweden was neutral in the world wars and was caught in a fairly difficult situation in regards to Nazi Germany, for example, and that the Germans had occupied Norway, the Finns were fighting the Russians, and Sweden had supported Finland with volunteers and some equipment at the beginning of the Winter War of Finland against Russia, because Russia's the enemy. And the Finns are Swedish cousins, in a way. But then Germany was a potential threat. Sweden didn't feel that it had the resources or the capability to fight an all-out war against Germany, and so decided to accommodate Germany's desires. And for Germany, it was okay if Russia, Sweden remained neutral, but you could say not antagonistically neutral. After the Second World War and in the development of the Cold War, it was very clear to the Swedish government that Russia was the enemy, or Russia was the potential threat. And Swedish defense policy was based around the idea of repelling or stopping a Russian invasion. And of course, because NATO's enemy was the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, there was a lot of common cause there. And so there was a lot of behind-the-scenes cooperation between the officially non-aligned Sweden and NATO. And so the current move towards NATO is not something that's come completely out of the blue, that there has been a certain amount of cooperation with NATO all along. And the Swedes have carried out joint military exercises with NATO for decades. that because of a common enemy. What's changing now is the idea of Sweden giving up 200 years of official non-aligned status to become a member of a military alliance, a defense alliance, which is going to call it, which is requiring some significant changes in everything from procurement to the law. Under most of the Swedish army is a mixture of professionals and national service conscripts, people who do 2 years of national service, which has been reinstituted. But the law specifically states that national service soldiers may only be used in the defense of Sweden. But joining NATO means that Sweden may be called upon to defend Poland or Turkey or who knows. And so it's a legal question now, can national service soldiers be employed outside of Sweden's borders to defend a NATO ally? And there are lawyers for the Defense Department who are trying to wrap their heads around that. And one of the questions they'll have to answer is, can they consider that the defense of a NATO ally is the defense of Sweden, or does that law need to be rewritten and does Parliament have to, the Riksdag, have to change the law as to how national servicemen are used? So, that's one of many conundrums or challenges that joining NATO will pose for Sweden.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating story, Fred. Thank you very much for sharing it with us today. And I think so important having that historical perspective.
Well, my pleasure to be with you, Sam. And as an historian, I'm always happy to see that the stuff that I'm studying from 400 years ago and more is relevant today.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, do please make sure that you leave us a review on whatever app you are listening on, especially if you are listening on iTunes. It's particularly effective. We'll read out any review that you leave. It's hugely important because it helps us climb up the rankings, and that helps us get as many people as possible listening to Maritime History on the Mariner's Mirror podcast. We also have a fantastic YouTube channel, so be sure to check that out with some really remarkable videos. Most recently, the animation of a cutaway of a 17th century first-rate man of war explaining how everything worked on a naval ship around the time of the Great Fire of London. The podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation, so do please make sure you do everything in your power to check out what those brilliant institutions are up to. In particular, please check out Maritime Innovation in Miniature. It's a brilliant new project filming the world's best ship models with the very latest camera equipment. It really is astounding. Just Google it, Maritime Innovation in Miniature. And please join the Society for Nautical Research. You can do that at snr.org.uk. It's a brilliant way not only of finding out all about the world's maritime history from the very best in the business, but also of meeting people. There's nothing wrong with it at all.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.